Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Thank you for tuning in once again to the Thursday show here on KSEV. And I want to remind you that just because we talk about certain subjects that you find appealing, it doesn't mean rush out and jump into the swimming pool just yet. Let's have you go speak with your current advisors, make sure that what you heard is correct, and that most importantly, it might fit your facts and circumstances, of which they should be aware. And if they're not, you're welcome to go fill out our intake forms on the BAPlannerShow.com website. And if you'll submit at least the first form, the client profile, and then you're welcome to go schedule a call at the call link right next to the forms link. Both of those are found on the homepage of BAPlannerShow.com, kind of towards the top center right, I guess you might say. So in any event, speaking of BAPlannerShow.com, I have a raft of new articles posted out to the news page under the Resources tab, which is essentially what we discuss for the bulk of each show. It has current relevant news going on in the world of commercial real estate or the larger economy as a whole, and we try to intertwine real estate concepts, tax strategies, etc., in with that news. And it's amazing how much is going on in our country today, not just on the real estate front, but all over. And speaking of real estate, I guess in the national news, it's good to see that Mr. Trump was able to seal the deal on his bond that had to be paid in here just a few days ago. And I tell you, he's seems like he always comes out on top somehow, some way. And I've been wondering why, with all the billionaires we have out there now, and of course, being a billionaire doesn't mean you're a liquid billionaire, but I would think, you know, to reach into your pocket and pull out half a billion dollars, if you're worth $20 billion or whatever the number might be, that ought to be something you might welcome to do in exchange for rubbing shoulders with the Trump brand. But in fact, I think that is what happened. The guy that put up the 157 million or whatever the number was, 175, I guess, million. Yeah, he was a auto finance mogul, and apparently it's not the first time he's loaned the Trump Organization money, but as he said, it was a good investment for us, meaning his companies. So that's great. It's a win-win. And let's hope that Mr. Trump is able to right the egregious behavior that's been waged against him, the lawfare, I guess, as it is. And hopefully he'll find someone in that appellate court that agrees with his point of view. And actually, it's, I think, most real estate executives' view that, you know, hey, the valuation, there's no black and white valuation when it comes to any given property. It depends on the perspective, as I'm sure you've all heard by now. But, you know, I've been working with real estate investors, developers, even had some banks along the way, and everybody does their own type evaluation depending on your perspective in the transaction. And is it permissible to have half a dozen different valuation approaches to the same piece of real estate? You bet it is. And again, I've yet to meet the lender that doesn't undertake some form of independent appraisal or valuation before they loan. Forget about the billions of dollars that these banks had loaned Mr. Trump. You know, how about just $200,000 or $300,000 loan? You don't think the lender does ample due diligence? They don't just accept the estimate of value. And you know, it's crazy to me that someone like the judge can just unilaterally ignore the sordid experts that Trump brought into the picture and say, no, we're going to value those assets at what really is very irrational values in most cases. But in any event, it was good to see he surmounted that threshold once again, and it'll be interesting to see what develops moving forward. Okay, so for those of you that are following along, the first article that I've got out on this week's news is the Hines organization, based there in Houston, has entered the build-to-rent market, acronym of BTR, with Pineville acquisition. And the Pineville, I believe, let me get this article up here. It is in North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. And let's see, I get a little delay here. Here it is. Yes, Pineville, North Carolina. And the only reason I'm bringing this out today is it is Hines' first build-to-rent acquisition. And just when I was thinking BTR was way overworked in terms of being the new poster child in the real estate business, someone that's a lot smarter than I, or an organization that's a lot smarter than me, is dipping their toe into that pond. And Hines, I mean, you can't deny they are literally the top of the game when it comes to being a first-class developer, operator. I think they pretty much do it all. I think they probably even property manage it, although maybe not. But in any event, they didn't develop this one. It was already developed. The seller is Landmark Properties, and I'm not sure if they were the original developer, if they bought it from the developer, but you can rest assured it's a little bit of an understatement here in the article. It says this announcement represents the firm's confidence in the growing sector and the Charlotte market. And that goes without saying. Again, they don't do anything halfway, and I'm always intrigued to follow what they do. And they do a lot of different development. They've developed office buildings, obviously, in Houston, you know, Pennzoil, One Shell, I believe Bank of America is still the one across from, still named the one there across from Pennzoil. Used to be, I think, the Republic Bank building back in the day when I was a young BBA and MBA graduate from U of H and went to work at Arthur Anderson Tax Department. And Arthur was located there in Pennzoil, and I watched, a couple years worth of that Republic Bank building at the time was its name, I'm pretty sure, be built. And boy, it seemed like it was never going to end as a big building. But in any event, so BTR is still a thing. Don't listen to me. Try to invest like Hines does, and you'll be very successful. Okay, the next article, we'll talk about this one before we go to break. There's a new payroll tax out that targets long-term health care. Thankfully, it's not at the federal level yet, but you might have guessed it. No, it's not Oregon. It's Washington, almost as bad in some respects. But it's the first state in the U.S. to use payroll deductions to help fund long-term care. And, you know, the $50,000 question here in the subtitle is, will other states like California and New York follow? And let's take a quick read through here. There's another new tax in the state of Washington. The state Supreme Court recently upheld a controversial capital gains tax, which has been rechallenged in court and could be the state's, or could be on the state's ballot in November for potential repeal. Now, a first of its kind state payroll tax aims to assist eligible families with a significant challenge, long-term care costs. I guess it may not just be health care the way they're phrasing that, but I have a feeling that that's what it is, and it's more of the government assistance that we all are, we have apparently a constitutional right to it in some respects, and I'm sure this will eventually find its way in to the federal picture, although it may not show up under the same name. I suspect it'll just be an expansion of Medicare or Social Security, which, as you should know, and if you don't, maybe we can update our numbers here this show. For it's been a while since we've actually looked at what the current deficits are trending as. Maybe we can do that before the end of the show today. But in any event, research has shown that long-term care expenses for those that cannot perform daily tasks independently exceed $100,000 a year for some. That's true in certain markets. I'm not sure about the state of Washington. Certainly is in the Northeast U.S. I think in Texas, you're probably right there on that mark, but in any event, this is kind of to me it's a surprising statistic. Data also reveal that 35% of beneficiaries of long-term care services are under age 65. I don't know about you, but I would have never guessed that. I would have guessed they were north of 70 or 75, but anyway. Let's see if there's anything else. Here we're talking about a definition of long-term care. Long-term care refers to various services provided to individuals with chronic illnesses or disabilities who require assistance in their daily activities. These services can be provided in different settings, such as nursing homes or assisted living facilities. More and more often, family caregivers provide in-home care, sometimes with the help of professional aides. Long-term health provides multiple challenges, one of which is significant financial strain. Long-term care expenses can be extremely high, that's for sure. And standard health insurance and Medicare do not pay for long-term care. That can quickly exhaust the savings and assets of family. And I know in Texas, Medicaid will pay, but only after you've spent down the assets of the party that's getting the care and their spouse. And it typically ends up bankrupting the spouse that's not getting the service. It's really a bad scenario we have. If you don't have some type of insurance, whether it's a rider that's been placed on an index universal life, cash value policy, which is the least expensive option, at least when you consider what else you're getting as part of that index universal life policy, because long-term health care coverage, if you wait until you're in your 60s to buy it, it's going to be really pricey, and even below the 60s, it's not inexpensive. But and then the other issue with just buying long-term health care coverage is you may be one of the 50% of all American couples, if you're married, that don't actually need long-term health care coverage in the end. And so you pay all that money, and then you have nothing, no legacy benefit to pass on to your heirs, etc. Whereas by undertaking an index universal life policy, yes, you'll pay more premium, but you're going to get not only a death benefit, you've got a cash value that you can borrow against for most any reason that you care to. And if it's structured correctly, the loan will not need to be paid back. It is very important that you have it structured correctly. It's not every insurance product that you can buy that'll fit it. You need to work with an insurance professional that understands the variables that have to be in that policy to make it the type that receives the favorable tax advantage. Otherwise, it can be a disaster when you start taking money out and you realize you're going to get taxed on it each and every year. So in any event, so let's go back to this article. Notably, the WA, that'd be Washington, CARES Fund, is financially supported by a first-of-its-kind state payroll tax. The funds to help residents pay long-term care expenses come from payroll tax deductions of 0.58 of 1%. Let's see, that works out to 58 cents per $100. It's just a little bit. That's where it starts. And, you know, we'll see later. It will have gone up. And again, you know, I admire the fact that we Americans can undertake programs like this for people that truly need it. I just, I wish we didn't. Yeah, I look at Social Security and I realize how many people receive Social Security that you could argue are well enough off where they wouldn't, it wouldn't change their life a whole lot if they weren't getting Social Security. But again, it's a social contract, and I don't know, haven't seen many people send it back to the Social Security Administration and say thanks, but no thanks. And I think most of us are so frustrated with the high levels that have been taken out of our paychecks that last thing we want to do is deny a little bit of the return of the fruits of our labor. But in any event, proponents of this act in Washington say that there's more than 3 million Washingtonians that could benefit from the program. According to A Place for Mom, the Senior Care Network, I'm sure you've heard their commercials, the average cost of long-term care in Washington State is over $5,100 per month. Other estimates put the average cost of long-term care in the state at more than $6,000. It's a big number, but it's nowhere near as big as it is, like I say, in places like New York, New Jersey, et cetera. There is, well, I guess a notable point here on this payroll tax is there is no income cap, meaning high earners will pay more. For example, if you make $45,000 a year, the WA CARES tax would be about $261 a year. If you make more than $120,000, long-term care payroll tax would be about $700 a year. So, you know, it's like the Medicare tax in that case, where the Medicare tax is paid on every dollar of your gross salary, and that's more than progressive. That's a lot progressive, but in any event. Okay, well, let's go ahead and take our first break, and we'll return momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
People always coming up to me and asking, what's your secret? With all you do, your attitude just seems to be so good. How do you keep it? Well, I'm not the Dalai Lama, but I
get to living, giving. Don't forget to throw in a little forgiving and love along the way. You better get to knowing, showing a little bit more concern about where you're going. There's a word unto the wise. You better get to living.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195. 713-581-0195. Or you can send an email to Nathan at NPRoss.com. Nathan at NPRoss.com.
Have you recently joined a real estate mentor program? BeAPlanner.com shows how real estate investments combined with proactive tax planning can generate significant wealth. However, syndication terms for private real estate partnerships are complicated. They help you assess the benefits of ownership from A acquisition to E exit. A planner wants to know what they are signing up for. BeAPlanner.com with CPA Nathan Ross. BeAPlanner.com.
Song, Bobby McGee, I'm just longing to be free. Take me where I want to be. Big dreams and fantasies. And there are many just like me
with big dreams and fantasies.
Okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we were just talking about a couple articles. Had an article about Hines getting into the BTR, the build-to-rent market, and first time they've done that. So I think that's a vote of confidence for that market. And then we were talking about an article that was in Kiplinger concerning the new payroll tax in Washington State that is going to fund long-term health care coverage. So in any event, it's more of the same on the tax front. It's like, you know, when you look at everything that comes out of a paycheck, and then you also consider the benefits that are being provided that don't necessarily come out of the paycheck. It's the time of year where we start seeing W-2s come in with our clients' tax data that we're working on preparing returns for, and it just amazes me to look at the dollars that it costs for the health insurance that's being provided. And I mean, it's just insane what insurance goes to these days. I know I've got clients that have family coverage, and it's almost $30,000 a year that the employer is providing. And, you know, that's more than most of the people that when I used to work, I mentioned having worked at Arthur Anderson. Of course, that was a long time ago, back in the 80s, 82, 83, somewhere in there, 84, I guess, as well. And that was more than most staff people started with their college degree, coming out of school. And it's just, man, we take it for granted. I know the inflation factor is a big chunk of that, but I tell you what, it's just scary how expensive these benefits have gotten. And that's before you consider any kind of matching on the 401, you know, any of the ancillary other disability coverage, and you know, just amazing what else is included on that W-2. But in any event, let's see. Let's go to the next article. Let's see here. Hang on just a second. I saw that I had the link wrong on one of our, on the Hines article. Let me fix that right quick here. Okay. You know, the concept of paying your fair share is always something I'm interested in, and I saw this article in the Wall Street Journal, I guess, when was it? March 29th, so about a week ago. And the subtitle is, in 2021, the richest 1% paid 45.8% of income taxes, up from 33.2% in 2001. So keep that metric in your head. Almost half of our nation's income taxes come in from the richest 1%. So now let's read through this article here. President Biden is proposing a bevy of tax increases, and his State of the Union address included the familiar call for the wealthy to pay their fair share, quote unquote. He should examine the Internal Revenue Service data. Recently released figures for 2021 show that the top 1% of Americans reported 26.3% of the country's adjusted gross income, while paying 45.8% of total income taxes. Is this not a fair share to Mr. Biden? Then what would be? And this is always a good question to ask those, typically those on the left, that will say this, that you're not paying your fair share. But when you try to pin them down on just how big of a pound of flesh they think constitutes fairness, you don't ever get an answer. You just get an answer that, well, you know, the school teachers shouldn't be paying the same level of tax, whether it's a pro rata percentage or whether it's actual dollars, as the wealthy. And yet, you know, last time I checked, we're both playing with the same Internal Revenue Code. We don't do a special version for the rich folks that we do for school teachers. I understand the way that we each make our money differs, and, you know, there are choices we make in life that help shape where we end up making a living. And I certainly don't live off of my capital gains. In fact, I have very few capital gains, except once in a blue moon when we sell a piece of real estate. But I don't have any Bitcoin. I don't have any way to avoid paying tax on earned income. Now, granted, the passive distributions we get out of partnership interest are not necessarily taxable, at least not initially. They usually are effectively when you sell or exit a property, because you recapture depreciation, as an example, which is what inevitably produces that cash flow on an interim basis. But in any event, let's see here. In 2021, well, I was just going to say, Democrats always deploy the language of fairness without defining it or answering those questions, just like I was mentioning. You ask and nobody can tell you. The truth is that the income tax is already steeply progressive. The top 10% of earners in 2021 provided 75.8% of the tax revenue to the nation. And top 10% goes down fairly low. Let's see, do they start with the bottom half. I want to say it's maybe $50,000 or higher, somewhere in there. Oh, here we go. Let's see. Well, this doesn't have the income. It just shows the percentage of taxes. But if I'm not mistaken, $50,000 or so annually gets you into that top 10%. And there's a tax foundation analysis linked in to this Wall Street Journal article that shows you these numbers. But in any event, this analysis does not include the payroll tax, which covers lower income workers. I mean, that, there's obviously a disproportionate hit to the FICA, especially the FICA tax, to someone that's making less than the FICA ceiling than someone that's making, you know, $500,000 a year. But in any event, start with the bottom half of earners, the 76.8 million returns that reported adjusted gross income up to about $46,500 is what makes that group up. That's the bottom half of all earners. In tax year 2021, they earned 10.4% of the country's total income while paying 2.3% of all income tax. Their average tax rate was 3.4%. Again, that does not count payroll taxes. The next group is between the bottom half and the top 25%, a total of 38.4 million returns that showed earnings from about $46,500 to $94,500. So I was wrong in saying $50,000 gets you the top 10%. We're getting ready to find it here. We're coming on down that chart. So the folks in the 46,000 to 94,000 strata reported 17.5% of income while paying 8.4% of income taxes. Their average tax rate was 7.2%. Move up to the cohort between the top 25% and 10%. 23 million tax returns with earnings from $94,000 to $170,000. They reported 19.5% of income, paid 13.4% of taxes, and had an average tax rate of 10%. It's not bad. Your gross earnings, $170,000, taxed at 10%. That's you know. Maybe that's not the fair share, right? I'm just kidding. The issue is spending, folks. It's not taxing. We tax plenty. Okay, between the top 10% and top 5% were 7.7 million returns with earnings from about $170,000 to $253,000. They reported 10.6% of income collections or earnings and paid 10.2% of income taxes with an average tax rate of 14.3%. Between the top 5% and 1% were 6.1 million returns with earnings from about $253,000 to $682,000. Average tax rate 18.9%. Finally, we come to the top 1%, another 1.5 million returns with earnings in excess of $682,500. Their share of income taxes paid was 45.8%, not quite double their share of income. So fair share, I would say if they're paying twice as much as what their income is pro rata, that's in my mind, that's more than fair. The average tax rate was 25.9%. Among the tippy top 0.1% or 154,000 returns, that's out of that 1.5 million in the top 1%. These are folks that had earnings above approximately 3.7 or 3.8 million a year, the average tax rate was similar, 25.7%. So, in other words, the burden of income taxes falls almost entirely on the top half of earners and disproportionately on the top 1%. Notice that tax rates rise steadily with income, a basic feature of a progressive tax code. The average income tax take is 10% or less for the middle class, jumping to more than 25% for the highest earners. You never hear the Democrats give you the statistics like this. They never do explain that the quote fair share appears to be living large already under the current tax rules. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, and I tell you this often on the air when I talk about Roth conversions, the tax rates have literally never been lower in most of our lives. A few of us old folks, it was, slightly lower, I guess, when we were infants or toddlers. But since then, the tax brackets have never been lower than they are right now, which is why you want to take advantage of the current ability to convert your pre-tax retirement wealth to Roth. And you want to do it before the rates start ticking back up. 112026. We go back to having more brackets with slightly higher rates. And then if we as a nation don't start dealing with the deficit, I would tell you 2028, 29, 30, along in that time frame, we're going to see markedly high. We're going to have to. It's just the math. Unless we're willing to take cuts, the Social Security system will have an across-the-board 23 to 25% per recipient cut. That's a lot to knock off your monthly check if you're in the unfortunate position of having to rely heavily on that. Social Security was never intended to be your retirement, but that's what it's become with all too many Americans. And so if you're living Social Security check, you're going to be in bad shape if we don't get out ahead of the trust fund problem that we have and start rebuilding that trust fund based on, there's a number of proposals. We make the retirement age higher. We needs test Social Security. These are all Band-Aids, and will have some effect, but I'm not sure. We're not going to escape cutting the Social Security benefits unless we change some major or make some major policy changes as to how we spend our tax dollars. But in any event, I do want to say that, the Biden proposal is nothing more than campaign fodder. All presidents provide the same type of proposals in their State of the Union speeches. Most of those proposals will never see the light of day. We can only hope that we treat our billionaires more fairly than what Mr. Biden would, because after all, the billionaires are contributing mightily in most cases to the economy and to the future of our country. In any event, let's do this. Let me look and see if there wasn't one more article I want to mention. Oh, one article. I'm not going to go into it, but I've got an article on data center demand. And if you're not in the know on what the artificial intelligence demands are in terms of systems and data centers and racks and racks and racks of storage and computing power is already causing, it's creating an incredible amount of demand for data centers worldwide. And Blackstone is involved in investing in these projects and properties. Amazon is a big investor, building some of their own data centers. And this will filter down, and it's not just the data center itself. It's the electrical grid and I guess even the protection for the electrical grid that needs to happen. And so I just dropped this article in there so you can read a few of the metrics, realize how heavy the demand is, how big the demand is. And I'm sure, you know, these projects don't really lend themselves to the passive investor on the scale of a 300-unit apartment complex. But obviously there are publicly traded companies out there that have investments in these types of projects available. And I would say this is an area that has ripened, it's matured. And I wanted you just to have access to some of these stats that are in this article on data center demand. And then let's see, I think that's all I'll go into there. Okay, so I sat in on a recent webinar for a new build project. It's in North Texas, suburb of Dallas, and I heard a few things that were interesting. I mean, these projects are starting to come back into existence. You know, things are really dried up in the syndication space as of late. And I guess, you know, the company that's producing this project has been around now for more than a few years. And they've got some projects in Houston and elsewhere. I think they've got some projects up in Dallas as well, if I'm not mistaken. But building a 330-unit, I believe this is a BTR as well, if I'm not mistaken. But in any event, this is a multifamily. I'm sorry. I should have known that. Luxury multifamily, Class A, and will be delivered into the market in 2025. They seem to think that this particular piece of the Dallas submarket is underserved. That's interesting. I've got statistics on absorption and on number of units both delivered recently and in the pipeline, and Dallas doesn't appear to me to be underserved, but hey, I didn't do the due diligence or the business plan, and I'm going to assume that somebody with their group has, and they feel comfortable putting a chunk of their own capital into the property. So I guess that's who be it for me to challenge their due diligence work. These units are going to cost $230,000+. A door. They aim to sell it in 2 or 3 years at $300 or $300,000 a door, and I guess it's going to be an upscale Class A. You know, $300,000 gets you there. Some units are selling for even more than that now, but not out in the suburbs. So I think that's probably right in the ballpark. And in any event, this developer's putting $3 million of their own money into play, and the investor returns on a minimum investment of $100,000 looks to be it's about a 2.08 equity multiple. So you basically double your money in 3 to 4 years, and you're sharing the profits with the developer on a 70-30 split, which given that there's no acquisition fee, there's no disposition fee, there's no refinance fee, there's not a whole lot not to like on the fee front. There's a 1.5% developer fee plus a construction management fee. You know, 2.5 points, that's, you know, higher than you'd like to see, but you know, given that there's, I mean, it basically supplants what would be a acquisition fee, I suppose, and maybe disposition fee, but at least it would appear to me they're working to earn that money. The 30% promote is something I'm seeing, excuse me, more and more on these transactions. I think the concept, pardon me, the concept of developers or syndicators getting away from the upfront fee burden is coming into favor finally. It's good to see. It's not totally there, but you know, the concept of taking money out on day zero really must change given the state of the market now. And you've seen a lot of deals go back to lenders, and I've yet to see any syndicator or sponsor reaching into their back pocket to help pay their investors back, many of which are retirement plans, IRAs, and solo Ks. But in any event, I'm not promoting this particular investment necessarily because we don't promote investments. We don't recommend investments, but I would tell you this. It's got a structure that seems to make sense. I can't tell you much beyond that. I haven't done any due diligence at the level they have on that area to know whether or not there really is a demand for this product. And, again, I'll leave that up to them and you if you decide you want to take a look at this opportunity. But happy to engage to help you review the assorted document stack that you'll get as part of the PPM and operating agreement, and understand that there are preferred positions that can be had in this deal, and that may be something of interest. Investors can get a preferred return of 10%, and again, minimum is $100,000, and that's projected to occur, or the return of that capital is projected to occur out in year four. So it'll be a while, so don't be counting on getting that core principal back until down the road. I don't recall seeing any kind of cap rate discussion. It may be in their slide deck. You can get that slide deck, by the way, if you want it. Send me a message, and I'll tell you who's doing it. This is for accredited investors only. If you're non-accredited, then you won't be able to participate. But I don't recall seeing the cap rate. I suspect it's in here. I was busy doing several things while the webinar was playing, so I missed it. But let's see, I was just flipping through it once again. Well, in any event, let's hope we've got more transactions coming down the pike here and that they're at least as attractive as this one appears to be. But in any event, let's see, since I've got a couple more minutes, let's see here. Oh, I wanted to mention, and this article is about a week old now. I don't think I talked about it on the Sunday show. I may have, but I just want to point out, for those of you that were thinking we might be getting a rate cut again, maybe in the month of May, I don't think that's going to happen now. The article on our website, latest inflation number suggests no May rate cut. And some in the Federal Reserve are arguing for an extended wait on reducing interest rates. And, you know, the CPI inflation numbers, which is probably the numbers that the governors, the Fed governors, rely on the most, is out. And it's a mixed bag, but the core PCE, personal consumption expenditures index, excluding food and energy, grew at an expected 0.3% month over month. These would be the numbers that came out for March. And an annual rate of 2.8%. The overall PCE index was also up at 0.3% versus the median forecast of 0.4%. And I know these sound like small amounts, but they're enough to where it creates uncertainty. And but in any event, the second GDP revision for the last quarter of 2023 also was announced at the same time. This was a week ago, and GDP was rose a bit, 3.4% increase versus the previous 3.2%. So, again, I don't know. I'll tell you this, if the jobs reports continue to come in like this, or that we had this past month, and the consumer spending continues like this, and, you know, I saw the price of oil had gone up slightly here just a day or two ago, and all that just points to a continued delay before the Fed starts reducing the interest rates. And unfortunately, that means you've really got to keep your eye on the ball within the multifamily space. Why? Because the cap rate that you're buying at versus the cap rate that you're exiting at, especially the one you're going to generate on exit, means everything in terms of whether you're getting all your money back plus whatever gain you're hoping. And you can't have that pro forma exit cap rate go up much, or you're not going to get there unless there's something else that ends up going to your favor over the pro forma info. But in any event, well, I believe we're at the end of the show, and I appreciate you tuning in. I hope you found it informative, and we will be back tomorrow, 11 a.m., right here, same channel, same place, 11 a.m. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
KSEV.